Today, I invite Dr. Debbie Hamilton, MD, MPH. She's a pediatrician with an experience in primary care, integrative medicine, lots of research, speaking, and writing, and she's a huge advocate for developmental disorders. Her education includes an undergraduate degree from Wesleyan University, followed by a medical degree from Chicago Medical School. She's board certified in pediatrics, physician nutrition, integrative and holistic medicine, and Institute for Functional Medicine certified practitionership, and has a master's degree in public health. And she also has done a ton of research on clinical nutrition. Dr. Hamilton founded Holistic Pediatric Consulting in Colorado in 2005, and her practice really focuses on treating children and chronic diseases such as autism and ADHD, and pre-consumption counseling based on her book, Preventing Autism and ADHD, Controlling Risk Factors Before, During, and After Pregnancy. In 2017, Dr. Hamilton joined Research Nutritionals, where she focused on clinical research, product development, and education of healthcare professionals. She continues to see patients through the Holistic Pediatric Consulting in Colorado through telemedicine consults. I can't wait to introduce her onto the summit. We're going to have a fabulous, fabulous discussion. One thing that I do want people to take note of is that the things that we're talking about today used to be truly controversial, but now there's so much science behind it, and it's really exciting to offer this as well. Well, awesome. Welcome to the forum. So happy to have you on.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me and including me.
Yeah. So, you know, you have such an interesting professional history, as I introduced you. And what a journey to go on from Master of Public Health to nutritional education and doctor and all the stuff like that. So, but our topic today is mood and developmental disorders in children. So happy to talk about that because I have three young daughters. I want to make sure that they're okay.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. So how common, by the way, are mood and developmental disorders in children?
Unfortunately, very common. And COVID didn't do us any favors. In terms of mood disorders, it was about 20%. If you look at kind of children, teenagers, and then COVID, it actually doubled those rates. If you think about depression, anxiety. And I've been seeing a lot of kids all ages who've really had a lot of issues. In terms of developmental disorders, the estimates were 1 in 5, 1 in 6 of children have some kind of learning or developmental issue. ADHD is like 10% of our kids. And as you know, a lot more in boys than in girls. This is kind of how I got in there. I've got a son with ADHD who's now an adult. He's doing awesome, but we had a journey ourselves. In terms of autism, when I started probably like 18, 20 years ago, just integrated medicine, it was like 1 in 150 kids with autism. And now it's like 1 in 30. 1 in 30 something. And again, our boys are much more affected. So the rate of increase is obviously can't be genetic, right? It can't be just generations who are moving too quickly.
What is causing this increase? Because we're seeing the same thing reflect in adult populations, worsening us, increased 60% increase in the diagnosis of Alzheimer's dementia in the last couple of years, right? So even in adults, we're seeing the same thing. Bipolar disorder is a huge one. Schizophrenia has increased dramatically since the pandemic, right? Like, what's going on here?
If you think about before and after pandemic, so I wrote a book because I had, children with autism, and then families are, what can we do if we don't have another child? And so I looked all the way back in preconception. So in terms of children, we have to look at their moms. So if the mom has inflammation, if she has infections, if she has autoimmune disease, if she has nutritional deficiencies, all those play a role. And so I feel like these kids, especially with autism, it's like the ultimate, there's so many different hits. Starting preconception. Right. More likely to be born by C-section, more likely to, not be nursed, although nursing, a lot of women are really toxic. So that's a whole other issue. There's definitely a diet nutritional impact. If you look at all the stuffs in our food, if you look at the whole microbiome, talk about the gut-brain connection, right? If you're born by C-section, you don't get that natural good flora to start. And if you're not nursed, you don't get it. And so that sets up your immune system. That sets up autoimmune disease, neuroinflammation, and start thinking about all the different toxicities we have from glyphosate, which I think is probably really underestimated. You know, if you look at some of the rates in the use of glyphosate and pesticides that go up, there's definitely genetic susceptibility, especially in mood disorders, but also in autism. If you have one child with autism, especially a boy, and you have another boy, the rates are really high of that and ADHD. So I think it's a really a combination of so many different things that we're doing in our environment and our diet. Like, and then not to mention EMFs. I mean, I feel like we're doing so many things that we really don't know long-term impacts at all.
Okay, so EMFs, electromagnetic fields, are one of the things. But what about psychological, emotional stress, especially preconception in utero? How much does that affect the child being born?
Yeah, well, if the mom has elevated cortisol, it definitely affects the baby in terms of setting up the HPA axis. And you think about that, a lot of these kids are in constant fight or flight, right? It's like they're born in fight or flight. And so our adrenals are stressed. A lot of times if adrenals are stressed, the thyroid's stressed. Thyroid hormone plays a huge role in terms of development, in terms of neurologic development. So I think that and what are women doing to cope with that stress? You know, what about the medications they may be on?
Right.
No, I mean, I think there's so many different factors, unfortunately.
And you talked about cortisol elevation, and I don't want people to listen to this and say, oh, cortisol is to blame. It's just a marker. It's just a marker that we look at for chronic stress factors, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. And in reality, you know, stress plays a huge and important part into the gene expression, what genes are actually expressed on a daily basis. So that plays a massive impact into developmental and mood disorders, adult and kids alone. Which it's kind of, you know, that kind of plays a role into our lifestyles and how we consume information in the modern age, right? There's a lot of social media and screen time and stuff like that. Let's have you just comment really quickly. How does something like that, like, you know, looking at screens and ideas coming in through social media, how does that really affect development and mood?
I think it leads to lots of, like, attention issues and ADHD issues. Because there's a constant flux of lights and sounds and people. And then they go in the classroom and they're supposed to listen to this without any of the visual. And I think it contributes a lot to stress for these kids. It's like they're more connected online, but they're much more isolated. And then the bullying and, you know, what they hear and the comparisons. And I think it's really stressful for these kids. And I said, I think they miss a lot of the other kind of development that kids are supposed to have. And the creativity on their own and individualized.
Yeah, absolutely. And I always sort of give this example when it comes to attention. So in 1990, when The Real World came out on MTV, it was really the first show that dedicated a specific filmography to sort of the ADD generation, which is what's called 4-second B-roll footages. And then I have a history in videography. So what it is that you have a 4 second before you transition into every scene. Now, if we look at that back in the day versus now, it's not a huge deal because right now the average transition is 0.7 seconds.
That's crazy.
So, right. Right. Attention has gotten shorter. So videographers are actually changing the style of media content. And now, of course, there's a huge explosion of short form media content on TikTok and Instagram Reels. YouTube shorts and stuff like that, right? And back in the day, it was Vine. So you have this explosion of short form content that now allows the person to just scroll through. They're actually making their own B-roll footage, just scroll through. Mm-hmm. And the more they scroll through, the more sort of that ADD mindset kind of kicks in. And so from a videography background, we know that based on marketing data, that these short form content, as well as the short B-roll footage, is 0.7 seconds, allows the person to stay on that video for X number of seconds longer in a specific population, usually aged between 11 and 16. So that's what the data is based on right now. That's what we're making sure there's short form content. Right. So that's concerning. And it's not the marketing company's fault. It's just that they're just reacting to what people's behaviors are. But that goes back to the brain, you know?
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Goes back to the brain and goes back to lifestyle. So let's touch on nutrition for a little bit because I think this is huge. So let's kind of have you describe, how does nutrition play this role into developmental and mood issues? And how do we know?
How do we know? I mean, some of it is from research. There's studies that show even if a mom is low in vitamin D, that the child has an increased risk of autism. If she's low in iron, the child has a risk. There's studies that look at certain levels of iron and zinc and omega-3s, ferritin, like an iron level of like below 30. And when you, you know, supplement these children, they actually get better. Their attention gets better. Their mood gets better. So we've researched that it helps, if that makes sense. So I think it's...
Let's pause there for a second. Yeah. You just said something super important that I see in my practice as well. You said that ferritin below 30 is correlated with mood and developmental disorders, right? Now, the average range on labs from a pediatric population, it says it's below 8 on ferritin. I don't know if you know this.
I know, so, it's gotten really low.
Yeah, so they're actually based on the standard deviation graph of most of the population. And so even if it says, like, you know, 25, they're still at risk on the ferritin, but on the labs, it doesn't light up red. And honestly, doctors don't really address that, right? And so unless they're like you and me, then we do address it a lot.
Right.
But ferritin below 30 is a massive massive portion of the population with that level of iron deficiency, right?
Right.
And so it's so important to know and understand that. And so, but that goes beyond nutrition, because, you know, I think there's other educational points with, especially with women and girls who have menstrual cycles, right, that there's blood loss, right?
Right.
And heavy menstrual cycles tend to make people at risk for losing that iron and thus turn into, you know, ADD and stuff like that. And I can't tell you how many times we find really low irons and we either do iron infusions or having supplement iron, and that improves ADD like 80%. I mean, just something that simple as well. Right.
I mean, you can't pay attention if you're basically anemic or low, basically it's low iron stores. What about sleep? Like, sleep doctors want like the ferritin about 50. So people don't think about even that. And, you know, sleep is one of our restorative healing modalities, and these kids aren't getting enough sleep anyway. Right. So it's kind of going to get into different parts of kind of health and nutrition. I mean, and then you think of our processed foods. Have you seen some kids what they eat? I think the pesticides play a role. And there are some studies on just food dyes itself and hyperactivity. You just take the food dyes out. And that was even recognized in the 70s. Like, Feingold first talked about it a long, long time ago. It's about 50 years at this point, you know, thinking about what our kids eating. The worst diet, one of the things I do in my practice is I take a diet record. You know, the parents write 3 days. And some of the kids with autism, I mean, they're eating 5 foods. I had one child come in, he literally ate white bread and candy. That was all he ate. You know, and parents get so scared about what they're feeding their child, or this child, you know, a lot of these, especially my children with autism, have, you know, sensory issues and texture issues and all sorts of stuff. But even kids who, when the parents say, oh, this is healthy, I'm like, well,
right.
You know, there's still a lot of things missing here.
Yeah, massive. And I don't think there's enough dedication to the role of nutrition in developmental mood disorders. There's just not a whole lot of attention on this as it should be. You know, we have the ability right now to do a lot of fancy different labs and diagnosis. So, you know, my area is quantitative EEGs. So, you know, earlier we talked about how sleep is getting affected, which contributes to a lot of developmental mood disorders. And of course, our brain regenerates during deep sleep. And we need 3 cycles of deep sleep to get there. And each cycle is about 2 hours. So those people sleeping under 6, significant developmental disorders, and they almost behave like kind of their little drunken stupor. But more importantly, I think that if you look at the EEG definition or EEG biomarker of inattention or attention deficit, and an EEG, basically, for those who are listening, is a device. So just like an EKG measures the electrical conduction of your heart, EEG measures multiple electrical conductions of your brain. And so there's something called theta to beta ratio, which is a biomarker of ADHD. Well, a theta to beta ratio that's high above 1 is impaired. Well, what does that mean? Well, it means that the brain is existing in theta waves more than the beta waves. Theta is sleepy and beta is awake. So the EEG definition of attention disorder is technically it's a sleep disorder because you have more sleepy brain than you have awake. And then when I speak to sleep neurologists about this, they're like, yeah, duh. You know, it's like that's the neurological definition. So we really have to marry like psychiatry and neurology together.
Right.
And so, so they started looking at drugs that can improve the theta beta ratio, like Adderall and Ritalin and stuff like that. But that doesn't necessarily get to the root cause, right? It's like a Band-Aid that can that gets there. Nothing wrong with the medications if you need it, but we still have to uncover the underlying things. But besides this fancy EEG device, and what do you use to look at this for developmental disorders and mood disorders like ADHD?
In terms of the, I don't look at the EEGs. I definitely have kids who.
In terms of labs.
Oh, yeah. In terms of labs. I mean, I have. I mean, I do basic blood labs. I'm, you know, zinc, iron, vitamin D, B12. I always look at thyroid panels. Obviously, the basic labs. Depending on the history, I might look at like food allergies and sensitivities. I usually do like an organic acid test. Some people call it the O test. Because it looks like, you know, get the dysbiosis markers. If they have more GI issues, I might look at a stool test. Mitochondrial markers, you know, if you don't get the energy in the cell, it's obviously hard to pay attention. There's a lot of mitochondrial dysfunction, especially children with autism, actually in depression too, and mood issues. There's neurotransmitter metabolites, detoxification metabolites, and some more nutritional markers. So those two are kind of like a good starting point for me. And I get a lot of information. And so that's usually kind of where I start. I always start with diet, you know, got to make sure the gut's doing well, anything metabolic, mitochondria. And eventually, depending on what's going on, then I look at more toxicity issues and things like that. So that's kind of my stage. So.
That's how we approach adult medicine as well. Now, you know, people listening to this, well, that's a lot of information. Where do you start? Well, you start with a good practitioner. That's where you start.
Right, yeah.
Someone that's able to guide you along the way. You know, you don't necessarily want to order things yourself. And some of these you can't order yourself anyways without a practitioner. But you got to get with people who know what they're doing. Yeah. So let's talk about the second brain or the gut microbiome, the gut bacteria. Mm-hmm. And so there's more neurons in the gut microbiome than it is in the actual brain. So there's a huge gut-brain axis that we have to accommodate for whenever we're looking at the disorders. So how does the gut-brain microbiome axis play a role in the development of these disorders?
Yeah, well, I think of it, I mean, there's the vagus nerve. So kind of there's a connection between the nerve, there's a connection between the circulation. I think of the microbiome as also kind of like a key to your immune system. You know, there's also a lot of neurotransmitters, as you said, it's kind of like there's a lot of neurologic issues that way too. If the immune system is not balanced, it sets you up for kind of more inflammation, which kind of plays a role in, you know, brain health in terms of neuroinflammation, like autism, and Alzheimer's is neuroinflammation. It sets you up, I said, for autoimmune disease. I think kind of a lot of that. I mean, there's definitely kind of a mood disorder issues, immune issues, kids get sick, chronic digestive issues. I mean, I don't know if that is, can you think of anything else that, does that make sense?
Yeah. So let me kind of piggyback on what you said. I think it's really important is that there's multiple factors, right? When people think the gut bacteria is just there and it does this sort of black box magical thing. It actually, there's a lot of connections there.
Right.
So, you know, you talk about vagus nerve first, which is my favorite topic of all time is the vagus nerve. The vagus nerve, by the way, for those listening, is a nerve that comes from the bottom part of the brain called the brainstem and has multiple different branches and it behaves like a vagabond. That's why it's called vagus nerve. It wanders everywhere. The wandering nerve, that's technically what it means. And where it goes to are a lot of organs. So the entire gut is controlled by the vagus nerve and the gut microbiome feeds back to the vagus nerve. It's a two-way street. And so as the nerve permeates through the gut and the microbiome actually has things that it does actually communicate with the vagus nerve. Well, what else does the vagus nerve connect with? Well, it's your immune system and the gut has a huge amount of immune cells in there. Called the gut-associated lymphatic tissue, as well as the gut itself actually is an immune organ as well as a digestive organ as well. And so now we kind of get back to the original question is, hey, why are people developing more disorders during COVID? And it's because, well, there's a bidirectional interchange. So there's a perception of stress. Stress affects the microbiome. Microbiome feeds back to suppress the vagal activation. So people are persistent fight or flight. And so even that amount of stress is all dictated by the vagus nerve and the immune system. And that's a huge, huge developmental construct in, you know, in my field is more, you know, Parkinson's dementia and Alzheimer's dementia and stuff like that. In your field is more autism and ADHD. But in reality, we're really talking about the same things between you and I, right?
Right.
Well, you know, I jokingly said this on another part of the discussion with someone else, but I kind of jokingly said it, but it was kind of in truth, is that like pediatric ADHD is basically, you know, what I would consider like mild cognitive impairment in developing into Alzheimer's. It's the same like spectrum and physiology, mm-hmm. right? And so, so we really have to address this, you know, much earlier on. You know, what do you think is going to move the needle the most in improvement in developmental disorders and mood disorders? Do you think it's the diet? Do you think it's trauma or relationships and connections people have? Do you think it has to do with toxins? Like, what do you think like moves the needle the most when it comes to healing from these?
I mean, unfortunately, I think all of those play a role. I mean, I said, I always think we have to get the moms healthy, because the healthier the baby starts, the better they have chance. You know, if they start behind and they've already been exposed to toxin in utero and, you know, missing different nutrients, as I said, they're already kind of behind the eight ball. So then they come out and depending what their nutrition is or their immune development, their gut development, it kind of sets them up. It feels like the multiple hit. You know, if there's only so many hits that they take before, as I said, they kind of, you know, regress, or the kids, you know, who start even from very early on with it.
But what about the moms who are listening now who maybe already have like 12, 13 year old diagnosed with ADHD? Is it too late to do something about it?
No, it's definitely not. I mean, that's always look at their diet and look at the nutrition. That's always a really good starting point. Because I said, there is definitely ways you can help them calm down and pay attention better. You know, it's interesting because the kids with autism have more of an like overt GI symptoms than ADHD. And as kids get, it is like ADHD to autism is a spectrum, just like you said, mild cognitive Alzheimer's, which is interesting. I never kind of thought of it like that. But I always go, you can't go buy good nutrition, cleaning up the house. In terms of toxins, you know, there's some real basic things, you know, how do you clean your house? What products do you use? What are you spraying? Are you spraying Roundup on your garden? You know, what do you use in terms of products? Organic food, you know, you started, it was like, oh, I don't know organic food. I'm like, the more and more you can, there's studies about how quickly organic food can kind of clear out some of the pesticides. You know, I think you do need to make some life changes like that. And that's a really good start. Kids need to get sleep. These poor teenagers are supposed to get up really early and they're naturally go to bed later. So we're really kind of a lot of teenagers are not doing well in terms of sleep. You got to get the kids outside, get them vitamin D, get them exercise, you know, get them off the screens, get them off away from their phones. We're trying to limit those in some level.
And these are huge because, you know, recently I talked to somebody, a parent, that was really concerned about their child. And it's interesting because the child is 30 years old. He's our relative, right? And he's like, man, he's spending a lot of time like on social media, a lot of time, you know, doing business development, et cetera, on the computer screen. And one of the things that we really talked about is like, why don't you like, instead of looking at your phone, looking at your email first and you get up, take that time and do a 10-minute walk. And it's so powerful how that one change in habit, you know, calmed his gut down. His bloating became less. He didn't eat any different. His bloating became less. You know, he's a lot more clear. And so it's not just about walking and exercise, about the intention. What you do throughout the day actually changes over time as well, you know, for that performance. And so, you know, but yes, you're right. I think that the gut toxins, and our ability to actually eat clean food is extremely important. I don't know about autism as much as most people like yourself, but what do you think is the difference? You said earlier that, you know, attention issues and mood issues are here, autism is here, but there's also a spectrum in between, right?
Right.
Yeah. What do you think delineates that spectrum? Is it just a diagnostic criteria, or is it something that's there?
I feel like, as I said, like sensory process and ADD, yeah, you know, there's like mood issues on that. And most kids with autism, there is some kind of mood, anxiety issues and attention issues. And as kids get, you know, with anxiety get better, they have a lot of ADHD. So I think it's more hit. The kids with autism tend to have more severe digestive issues, more severe immune issues, if that makes sense, more autoimmune issues. Right. And the ADHD is like, there's definitely like, you know, lead toxicity and nutritional component, but much less GI issues. So I feel like there's a more inflammatory component to autism. They're sicker in some.
And that makes sense on why the statistics are getting worse in all the populations, right? We're seeing more autism, we're seeing more ADHD. Now it's like the standard, you know, 10% of the population have ADHD. Who knows? I mean, maybe in a couple of years it'll be 20%, right? And so there's something about our environment that's really changing, that's creating more of this. And some people argue, well, maybe we're just diagnosing more. I actually don't think so. We're still underdiagnosing as well. I think that what's happening right now is that there is a huge shift in the way our lifestyles are.
Yeah.
You know, back in the 19, right after World War I is where all the sort of explosion of pesticides really came in, right? The pesticides allowed the wheat crops to be much, much more bountiful, the waste to be much less, so that they're shorter, but they actually have more grains, which also unfortunately increases the amount of gluten that's in them. And then now the newer toxicities is more like technology-based. You know, we talked about EMFs a little bit earlier, which could be an issue. And then you also have plastics, right? And then I'm in Texas, so we have petroleum byproducts within our soil. So every patient I test has it in the urine. You know, I haven't seen one that's negative, right? And so we're seeing a lot of the toxic world, you know, come into play with these things. And so are there things that we can do to defend ourselves beyond like nutrition and, you know, beyond stress reduction, something like that? Well, for example, what are some supplements that may be key to address this?
I mean, if you're thinking of detoxification, things like glutathione, milk thistle, things that help kind of your liver detox, because if you're exposed to so much, I feel like your body can only handle so much. You know, we talked about things like vitamin D. If your vitamin D is higher, your immune system's stronger, you're less allergic potential, less problems with blood sugar. You know, if you have iron and zinc, I mean, zinc in terms of, I was taught no zinc, no think. You know, it's involved in so many different cognitive process. Mood is great. If you have low zinc, that's the rage behavior, right? The 0 to 60, you know, you get upset so quickly, poor stress tolerance. I use some targeted B vitamins, things that I look at some genetics too. We didn't talk about that much more than MTHFR, but sometimes it's like, oh, they really need active B6. And I think most people are low on magnesium, which is a really calming kind of mineral. Omega-3s are mood stabilizing. If you get them at high enough levels, that's huge. You talk about the bipolar, or like the kids who are just like up and down and everything else. I've looked at hair tests. There's like low lithium, right? Nutritional lithium can make a difference in terms of stability. I think in that there are some supplements. I use like some of the calming herbs. I use adaptogens. You know, we talk about that cortisol stress response. People are like this, and then they're burnt out. You know, let's get to homeostasis, like ashwagandha, right? Things like that.
And it's so individualized, you know. I wish we could be super general, but it's so individualized.
That's
and
true.
Once again, it's things to work with practitioners on, especially functional practitioners, when it comes to from this topic. And sometimes, you know, as parents, they can get kind of lost too and kind of overanalyze certain things as well. And that's, you know, there's a reason for that, right? They want to protect the child, and that's totally understandable. But sometimes the complexity could be the enemy of progress as well. So certainly for those people who listen to this, please work with an actual practitioner on this rather than do it yourself. You don't have to be alone when it comes to this. So what do you think is going to slow down the diagnosis and development of these disorders in our future generations? Because I am truly concerned about my kids. I'm sure you are too.
Yeah, I mean, I'm at the point where my kids are in their 20s. So, you know, and a lot of kids that age are like, oh no, the world's in such bad shape. I mean, you know, climate change and environment, everything else. And some of these kids are like, I don't want to have kids. I don't want to bring kids in this world. So yeah, we really do need to, I mean, I think I'm like, there's got to be some kind of like understanding of where we are, like some reality where we are. And I looking at what's in our environment, looking at the EMFs and going to 5G, what is that really impacting? You know, parents a lot of times need to get involved in what their kids are eating, but what they're exposed to. All the way up to, you know, things that you do in your home to all the way up to like climate change and more political things. But there's got to be... I think there's got to be preconception testing. I think we need to really look at mom's health, because if you don't get the mom healthy, because your kids are already starting behind the eight ball. So I think there's got to become recognition and some kind of, people need to be aware of how severe we are, or like the mental health of our kids is awful. And there's an interesting role of that, but the social isolation and COVID did us not any favors. It was a horrible time for many, many people, and our kids really, I mean, those poor teenagers who were in high school, and my kids were in college, you know, I mean, like so much of their development was just like literally cut short.
Yeah, and it sounds like awareness is absolute key, and that's part of the reason we're doing these forums and these summits, right? It's just awareness behind it,
right?
I think that as we go forward, the stigma of being diagnosed with mental health issues and even brain health issues, it's got to go away too, right? Mm-hmm. I think recognition earlier, has to be the foundation of our language. You know, we're in this era of cancel culture where basically people are always put on guilty before proven innocent, and especially when it comes to like social media and stuff like that. And that's the world we kind of live in right now, right? It's like there's always going to be naysayers, there's always going to be different things like that. But as soon as someone speaks about something or speaks out against or for something, there's a lot more ability for negativity to creep into their lives because of how connected we are on social media as well, right? And not just social media, but all of media as well.
Right. Think of how quickly our world has completely changed. You know, I mean, even my kids' generation, you know, in that 20 years, how different things are. You know, things are happening so quickly, we really don't know the ramifications of what we're doing. I don't think so.
Right. So if we take just a random population of teenagers, right, in 2022, throw them back to 1986, okay? My gosh, what difference 40 years has made, right?
Yeah.
Because they're gonna always kind of be looking for stimulation because there's no social media to reach for on phone and stuff like that, right? And the television is gonna look so boring because these B-roll footages are not under 0.7 seconds, right? And so the stimulation is not quite there. And then the world looks so different at that time. And so we got to be able to go backwards a little bit and think about, well, how are we going to engineer our lives to be far more resilient, right? Because technology is because in the next 10 years, you know, majority of our kids are going to be immersed in the metaverse, right? There's going to be virtual reality, augmented reality it already exists, but now that's going to be the new standard. There's even these platforms that are being developed within VR, like cognitive behavioral therapy and stuff like that. And so we're really diving into a massive amount of unknown of where consciousness really goes. But that means we, like right now, we have the really the ability to kind of go back and ground ourselves in our lives. And like, you know, taking a walk outside right now is still the same as taking a walk 10,000 years ago. You got to be doing things that ground yourself, you know, 10,000 years ago. They can do it. And so the ability, I think, for our society to really self-contribute into the improvement of brain disorders is really just education. As you said earlier, preconception testing, right, is so important. Now, what do you test for in the pre-sim session? Same things like vitamin D and iron and stuff?
Yeah, some nutritional stuff. I think, look, they don't routinely test thyroid. If you can get mom even before pregnant, looking at toxicity, looking at her cleaning up her diet, definitely organic foods, getting those levels, getting her iron levels, you know, a good place, getting her vitamin D levels before she even gets pregnant. Does that make sense? You know?
Yeah, absolutely.
Getting her gut, getting her gut. You know, all those people who have IBS, right? Or probably have some kind of dysbiosis, getting that in better shape, because that's setting up her child's immune system.
Yeah, absolutely. You know,
so I think there's a lot we can do, and I think the earlier the better.
But the general physician population, you know, is not necessarily educated on what those levels should be. You know, earlier we said that, you know, ferritin below 30 is at risk for child developing these disorders, right? And, you know, my wife's an OBGYN. This is not part of the guidelines for ABOG, American Board of OBGYN, right? Or ACOG, American College of OBGYN. These are not those guidelines, right? Mm-mm. And so, and we need it to be part of the guidelines because brain development is so dang important in the kids, right? And these are really preventable things. But I think it really takes conversations like me and you right now to kind of get this out into the wild and say, hey, you know what? There might be something better to do than just looking at normal lab values. How about optimal lab values, right?
Or thyroid lab values, the same thing. Or vitamin D levels below 30. And most people in integrative medicine, like, 30, oh my God. You know, somebody said that's normal. Like, no, that's not good. You know?
Yeah. But you know what? The really cool part is very recently, in the last few years, those doctors in high-risk obstetrics and REI, reproductive endocrinology, are now recognizing that. And they have a new sort of foundation. Those doctors in fertility are understanding this now. It's until very, very recent. Even though we're talking about publications that are decades old, it's not until very recent that we're getting that direction. So I feel pretty good about it. But, I mean, a lot of this really needs to get out, you know? And I'm very lucky to have young daughters that are pretty healthy. You know, they're 1, 6, and 8. They're all very healthy.
Oh, very young.
Yeah, they're very young. And so, and it's great because we have a lifetime of opportunity to optimize that. But, you know, but even if people are listening to this, really trying to find a solution for their child, if the child is diagnosed with autism, ADHD, bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, whichever one it is, we're still talking about the same fundamental principles of life, right? And the last thing that we'll talk about before we end this is genetics. Now, autism, there's a huge thought process within the public that, okay, it's genetics, you know, we're screwed, we can't do anything about it, right? What proportion of that is genetics, and what portion of that is something outside of genetics?
Yeah, well, I think you have to define genetics. I mean, it's only 5 to 10% that are quote genetic, and genetic being like something chromosomal, like fragile X, or like a 16 deletion. Mm-hmm. So that is a very small portion. But if you think about genetic SNPs, which are, I think of different enzymes that have different capabilities, so some can work faster or slower. And those need like certain nutrition, like certain nutrients to go with it. So if you look at some of those, like some people can't detoxify as well. They have SNPs in their glutathione or the whole, you know, methylation stuff pathway, like the MTHFR. You need that to make DNA to work. You need that to work to make neurotransmitters. So there's kind of how a lot of people think about genetics. And then there's kind of, we all have different genetic SNPs. We all have differences, but there's certain ones that will set you up for more problems. So look, if you're like, we might all be exposed a certain amount of lead, but if you can't detox it, then you might have a lot more problems from it than somebody else. So, I mean, I think there's different ways. I think there's more of that genetic SNPs as opposed to like, you know, Down syndrome or Fragile X or something like that, if that makes sense. A lot of kids with Down syndrome are high, high risk of autism. Very high risk.
Mm-hmm. And these kids are also at very high risk of sleep disorders. You know, sleep apnea, for example, is huge amongst the autism population. I think it's actually one of the most underdiagnosed things because you need air to go to the brain. It's those kids with sleep apnea, oxygen goes down at nighttime. I mean, that's kind of vital to the brain healing process as well. And we're seeing on another part of the summit, I actually had Dr. Felix Liao on. He's a biological dentist that educates on airway and brain development disorders, right?
Oh, okay.
And so, we talked about how so much of the food that is eaten these days are so softer and processed that the child does not have an ability to develop an adequate upper palate or upper and lower palate, but the adequate airway. So that leads to sleep apnea, sleep issues, which is basically 1 in 4 of the human population at this point has some sort of sleep disorder, right?
That's crazy.
And so
these kids have low muscle tone too. I mean, a lot of these kids have really low muscle tone, and that's part of the, why they can't speak, because their muscle tone even in their jaw, or they can't chew hard food, as you say, because they don't have enough strength to chew.
Yeah.
So that contributes. Yeah. That would contribute to sleep apnea too. That's an interesting connection there.
Yeah, so the act of chewing also stimulates different hormones in the brain, oxytocin, you know, the brain's really required for the healing process, melatonin, these all require chewing processes, right? Mm-hmm. And so, and there's a lot of things that are there. And sometimes I feel like, you know, parents blame themselves so much, oh, maybe I didn't feed him or her right and X, Y, and Z, but it really, there's no need to blame. If you're a parent listening to this, there's really no need to blame yourself. We live in a world where it's kind of set up for these things. So we just have to take it one step, you know, at a time. But anyways, but this has been a fabulous conversation, a very enlightening one as well. I really want to thank you for coming on and talking about this. How can people find you and your book?
Yeah. Oh, no, I said, I want to thank you very much for, you know, definitely a very interesting conversation. So thank you.
Thanks. Yeah. So how do people find more about you and more about your book?
My website, which is actually being updated, which is holisticpediatric.com. And the book is Preventing Autism and ADHD, and that's on Amazon.
That's amazing. Yeah. I'm gonna go get it now.
Okay, sounds good.
Yeah. Well, thank you for coming on once again. Thanks everyone for listening. I hope you got a lot of this. Appreciate you coming on.
All right. Thank you. Take care.
Take care.
Bye-bye.